Our second talk this morning is by Ian Williams, standing before us, foreign correspondent for 25 years for Channel 4 News, and then America's and then for America's NBC. He's been based in Moscow and then Asia. He's written several books, the latest of which was only published in August, The Fire of the Dragon, China's New Cold War. The title of his presentation today is Imagining Green for the Cyber Age. Over to you, Ian.
Yes, a cyber Graham Greene, a cyber thriller by Graham Greene. Could we imagine that? First of all, a little bit of background on myself, because that might explain how I came round both to being so fond of Graham Greene as a novelist, as a journalist, and also of cyber issues. I was, as Chris said, a foreign correspondent for 25 years, and I think that Graham Greene novels should be required reading for any self-respecting foreign correspondent for a whole host of different reasons. I started, my first foreign posting was in Moscow, in Russia, in the early 90s, when the place was pretty chaotic. For Channel 4 News, and I also went for Channel 4 News after that to Hong Kong to cover the handover, and then stayed with Channel 4 News in Asia, covering China, the Far East, and frequently places in between, until 2006, when I defected to the Americans, which probably wouldn't have gone down well with Graham Greene, and joined NBC News. Covering the same areas for them and frequently places in between. After I left journalism or stopped being a foreign correspondent, I wrote a novel called Beijing Smog, which was a sort of satire really on modern China, and where the hero, for want of a better word, is an internet meme that goes viral and creates all sorts of problems for all sorts of characters, but particularly for the Chinese Communist Party, which doesn't have a sense of humor. I then came back to the UK, and I was so interested in cyber issues that I did a master's degree down at Royal Holloway. Out of that came a second novel with the same character from Beijing Smog called Zero Days. My most recent two books have been non-fiction books, which one looking at the Chinese surveillance state called Every Breath You Take, another looking at modern China and the world, which is the new one, Fire of the Dragon. Now, I think when you look at Graham Greene as a foreign correspondent, you're immediately drawn to him as a journalist, as somebody who, in his writing, was unparalleled in his description of time and place and location. And for me personally, it was also that the moral ambiguity, the ethical ambivalence, all of these factors were important. And when I used to travel, I used to find I would take Graham Greene novels, even ones that I'd previously read, on the road with me as a source of relaxation, of entertainment, of inspiration, even occasionally as a kind of guidebook. Now, I was sent by NBC News to Haiti in 2010, just after the earthquake there. And of course, The Comedians is set in Haiti and is one of my favorite novels, and that was almost a guidebook in many ways, because the Haiti at that time was still a ramshackle, impoverished, and very corrupt place. It had been shattered by the earthquake, which had killed 2,500 people, I think, and probably would have been much higher had it not been the fact that the buildings were so poorly constructed, that when they collapsed, there was not really much of them to bury people under. The buildings were so poorly constructed that they probably ended up saving a lot of lives. At the time, there was a joke going round that is not an old joke, I think it's a fairly recent one, that Haiti was 80% Catholic and 100% voodoo. And this would have, of course, continued to have appealed to Graham Greene. I stayed in a small ramshackle hotel, which had been shaken by the earthquake, but luckily after about 3 days, the owner had plastered over the cracks so that we perhaps wouldn't notice. And in that hotel, we had a motley group of fellow residents who included the Animal Protection Society from the United States, as well as a collection of missionaries. Within about a week, several of the missionaries had been arrested by the police and accused of trafficking. They'd come over, these were evangelicals, they'd come from the States with a mission to rescue children who'd been affected by the earthquake. And their idea of rescuing kids would be to go to orphanages or other places where kids had been were being looked after the quake, load them on a bus, pay the appropriate bribes, and bus them across to the Dominican Republic. This horrified the UN and others, who argued that something like 80 or 90% of children who are displaced during an earthquake have living relatives, and it's just a question of methodically tracking down those relatives. Keeping them with their family is always far more preferable than shipping them off to another country. And these missionaries had the best of intentions. They thought they were doing God's work. They thought they were helping people who had far less than them, and by shipping them to the States, it was going to improve their quality of life. And I was, at this point, thinking of Pyle as in The Quiet American, and the line there where Fowler says, "God rescue us from the good and the innocent." And the Prime Minister, who I interviewed about this subject, because there was a lot of sympathy in the States for these missionaries who were somehow not being allowed to do their God's work as it was presented by the church. And I put this to the Prime Minister, that all they're doing is being taken to the States for a better life. And he said, "Well, if that's the case," he said, "why don't we disassemble every available ship in the world and send the entire population of Haiti to Miami and see what kind of welcome they get?" During that visit, I also, when it became a little bit more possible to travel around in Haiti, I traveled to Lee Olafson Hotel, of course, which is the center point of the Trianon, I think it was called in the novel. And it was still as ramshackle as it was described by Graham Greene. It had stopped taking guests because of serious cracks in the facade, although the bar was still functioning, which would have appealed to Graham Greene. But they'd stopped doing their Friday night music event, which used to be renowned in Port-au-Prince because it was this sort of hybrid of jazz and voodoo music, which is quite a unique sound, and the hotel used to promote this, and it had become extremely popular. It was, when I finally got there, it was pretty empty, pretty decrepit. The bar was just about functioning, but I felt very pleased that I'd actually been able to get to see the hotel, of course, which is such an important centerpiece in that novel. Now, when we think about Graham Greene and the time in which he was writing, a number of things come to mind when we look at the modern era, today's world, which provoke really questions about how he would have handled it. Cyber, computers, the internet is, of course, something I should come to in a moment, but also the far more complex geopolitics. Greene was writing during the Cold War. There was a strong streak of anti-Americanism in his writing. There was a strong sympathy with liberation movements worldwide. And I sometimes wonder how he would have handled the modern geopolitics, the more complicated world. The rise of China, for instance. He did go to China, I think, in 1957, when there was a brief opening, the hundred flowers bloom period, when he was part of a group who were invited to China. From what we know, he didn't particularly enjoy the experience. And soon afterwards, of course, Mao had used that period of openness to bring out his opponents, to encourage criticism, and then, of course, promptly suppressed it once he'd identified the people he needed to suppress. I wonder also whether what he would have made of Putin's Russia, the emergence of a state which, you know, in many respects, in 1930s, we'd have called it fascism. And I wonder as well in his choice of hotspots, which he obviously always liked. I mean, he was, and again, it's another reason why a journalist or a foreign correspondent is drawn to Green, because of the way he was drawn to dangerous places, to the world's hotspots, to places, I mean, Greenland, I think, is how it's sometimes referred to places which are in their own ways a little bit desperate. And of course, that is very much the habitat of the foreign correspondent as well. And of course, with Green, a lot of his work emerged out of his journalism. And I wonder whether, if he were with us now, he would be somewhere in Ukraine, whether he would be on the fringes of the Donbass, whether he would be looking at the suffering there. I mean, I think he once said that if he had an ideology, if he had a, his belief was always, his commitment was always with the victim. And that was a movable feast because victims change. But I think that, I wonder whether he would have been drawn to a place like Ukraine in the current context. Now, when we look at the cyber world, the internet, the rise of computers, and the pervasive surveillance that we see around, whether it's what has been dubbed surveillance capitalism, the sort of the cookies and the sort of way in which you are followed around in everything you click on, everything you buy, by those wanting to sell you more stuff, or by state surveillance, as well as the erosion of privacy. And it strikes me that there are two areas, really, when we look at how, we ask the question about how Graham Greene would have responded to the cyber age. And one is on a personal level, and one is on a professional level, how he might have made it work in his books, or in his movies. I think on a personal level, he would have been horrified, because he was a person who very much prized his privacy, and he was also a man who did not like the celebrity. He shied away from the celebrity culture, from the bright lights of celebrity. And of course, both of those now are very prevalent. I had a conversation with a publisher the other day, who told me that he'd more or less stopped commissioning fiction unless the author had a very strong social media presence, because they saw this was a way of kind of driving sales and driving the book. Then with the next breath, he told me, of course, well, I don't do social media. But he saw that now as, you know, in a more challenging publishing environment, he saw it as being very important that his authors, especially of fiction, should have that social media presence. And I wonder, would Graham Greene have done Twitter? You know, this is a medium which in many respects is regarded as very important by authors, celebrities, journalists. but it's also a place where you have trolls and others, intimidation and other trolling is rife. And you also have a situation, not just with Twitter, but with other related platforms, where it has supercharged almost the purveyors of alternative truth and alternative reality. And I think as a medium, maybe I'm wrong, maybe he would have adapted to it, maybe he would have had people that would have done his tweets, but I just imagine that he would have been quite cynical about the whole medium of social media, and probably would have been quite horrified by the growth of it and the intrusion, that the explosion in online celebrity and the intrusion on fiction. I mean, the intrusion rather on his own privacy. Now, looking for clues in his background about how he might have reacted, we know from biographers, I'm grateful for Richard for this little anecdote, that during his wartime service with the Secret Intelligence Service, that he worked in the Ministry of Information, of course, which in its own way was generating versions of the truth on behalf of the British authorities. He also worked in Freetown and Lagos, where he was reportedly had a fascination with coding and decoding. So these are little clues, really, that it may well have fascinated him. Now, my guess is that on a professional level, he would have, though, embraced the cyber world, because there are smokes and mirrors in abundance. There are very little black and white. There are all sorts of shades of grey out there. There are all sorts of alternative and dark secrets lurking. And I think he would have been quite fascinated by the potential of a lot of these aspects, a lot of these characters, to enhance his fiction. There's a scene in some of his later novels where you see the emergence of some of these themes. In The Honorary Consul, when Dr. Pla goes to Gruber's photo lab, you recall that Gruber's a German businessman in the little town on the Paraguay-Argentine border, where and Dr. Pla, who's the main protagonist in the book, goes there to drink beer with Gruber, and they go into the back room, and Gruber's set up a surveillance camera. This is 1974, I think, 73 when the book came out, which Green described as a sort of candid camera device, and says that Gruber loves his gadgets. And they sit there drinking beer and exchanging comments about the customers that come into the shop as they take their photographs that have been developed and the expressions on their face of joy or horror and there's about, I think there's two or three pages in the book which are devoted to this, and you can kind of see the emergence of a sort of fascination with that, and you do wonder that this is one of his last novels, but if you do wonder how he might have taken that theme had there been later novels which could have got on top of that. Yes, he said, I'd noted down here, while he's sitting there drinking beer with Gruber, cries of excitement, chattering like birds, as he describes people in the other part of the shop who he is surveilling. Then I sometimes look at other scenes and wonder the potential there for a cyber intervention. For instance, our man in Havana, Wormwood, is of course a vacuum cleaner salesman. And rereading that book recently, it coincided with a controversy in the newspapers over Amazon's purchase of a company called iRobot for $1.7 billion, who's made the Roomba vacuum cleaner. It's a robotic vacuum cleaner. And the vacuum cleaner essentially goes around your house and maps your house. And as it learns about your house, where there is dust, where the furniture is, and multiple other bits of information, it crunches this. So the more it's used, the more effectively it can be left to its own devices and wander around doing the cleaning. You know, you just switch it on. And of course, the purchase by Amazon raised a lot of concerns because Amazon hoovers up data in numerous different ways about you. And the more Amazon devices you have, whether it's one of those things that listens to you or whether it's simply through what you buy on Amazon, they use this information to make recommendations about what it thinks you could or should buy. And of course, the addition of Roomba to this arsenal of data collecting devices that Amazon has is in many respects quite chilling. It's also, according to cybersecurity companies, riddled with issues, potential cybersecurity concerns, which means it could well be hacked, and people who you don't want to know about the arrangements inside your house have a pretty good picture of where you keep things. There's a little camera on the front, by the way, that crunches all this data. And I thought to myself, how would that have worked? Maybe if I could have made an interesting twist in the story if Wormwood had access to an intelligent vacuum cleaner. I also was fascinated when you reread, for instance, Brighton Rock, and you wonder in a contemporary Brighton Rock, would Pinky perhaps be a hacker or a cyber criminal? Because, of course, the conventional gangland crime, it's still there, of course, but in terms of sheer money generating, it's, if you know, cyber crime is very lucrative now, and it's a lot easier. You're just sitting behind a computer, and a lot of the devices and the tools you can use for cyber crime, whether it's ransomware, freezing someone's computer and then demanding they pay you a ransom before you give them the key to unlock it, or other types of fraud. It's, you know, it's very easy to perpetuate. You can buy the tools to do that on the dark web. You don't really need computer expertise. And I wonder how that might have been handled. Then if you look at The Quiet American, set in Vietnam, where Fowler frequently goes up country to the front line to look at the challenges and the problems that the French are having. And then sometimes he's quite leisurely sitting on the story. Maybe he'll file it in a few days, maybe not. And in a contemporary sense, the way the news business works these days, and a lot of his characters are journalists, it's so instant. And you see it in the Ukraine war. There's never been a war like Ukraine in terms of coming into your living room, on your phone, on social media. You know, a lot of what is going on is more or less streamed live. We've never had such access to a war and to the daily, almost hourly events that are taking place. And I wonder also, this is another product of the information age, how Green would have handle that at a time when the leisurely foreign correspondent is very much an endangered species. And these days it's much more individuals with smartphones uploading video clips, little bits of information or photographs, and access worldwide almost instantly. And it's, again, that was something which I was very, very intrigued by. You see, I think that there's Graham Greene's ideal location, that the sort of places he liked to go to, Greenland, as it has been dubbed, I think the cyber world would fit quite nicely into that because of the subterfuge, because of the uncertainty, because of the smokes and mirrors. I think it would have been an important element in the way that he told a story, because in some respects it magnifies human frailties. It magnifies the sort of moral and ethical ambiguities that run through a lot of his books. You only have to look at the way often that hackers are characterized or categorized. You have white hats, you have gray hats, you have black hats. And what they mean by this is your white hats are the security researchers employed by companies looking for bugs and looking for ways of sort of saving us from those bugs. The black hats are on the other extreme. They're the ones looking for bugs in order to hack you and to get money from that. And in the middle, you've got this big group of gray hats who are sort of mercenaries, really, and they'll be looking for bug bounties from companies that pay if somebody discovers a flaw in their software and will want to buy it from them in order to patch it. But it's riddled with all sorts of variations on those themes. It's a very complicated and messy world out there when it comes to cyberspace. And I think as much as personally he might have been appalled by it, I think that professionally, when it would come to writing, I think it would have intrigued him. And I think it would have excited him. And I think it would have made for an intriguing novel or novels. Now, during the course of my own writing, I came across a number of events and characters which intrigued me, but also posed the question, what would Graham Greene have made of that, or him, or that situation? Because they had an absurdity about them. And of course, one of the themes that runs through a lot of his books is this fine line between tyranny and absurdity. And this fine line between the madness of the world, and he's able to laugh at some of these tyrants. And of course, humor is a very powerful weapon. And there were several instances that I came across which struck me as being very Greene-esque, and I wondered whether, you know, would that make a starting point for a Graham Greene novel or an element in it. And I'll just run through some of these for you, see what you think. For instance, when I was researching my book on Chinese surveillance, I came across this instance. It was in California, and you know, Chinese cyber espionage has been rampant. And they wanted to try and obtain some information from a US oil company, and they were having difficulty getting into the system by conventional hacking. But the software engineers at this oil company used to use a local Chinese takeaway in order to order in. And what the hackers did was they put bugs, they put malware into the electronic online menu of the takeaway. So that when the software engineers went to order, I think it was General Tsao chicken, they got a lot more than crispy chicken. And it was and I thought that was intriguing. And then characters. What would Graham Greene have made of Winston Edwards? Let me tell you about Winston. Winston's claim to fame was about a year and a half ago, when he emerged with angry tirades on his Twitter and Facebook account, in which he said that it was absolutely outrageous. He claimed to be a leading microbiologist, and he was very angered at the unreasonable criticism of China over COVID. China was being perfectly helpful, perfectly reasonable, and the American authorities were criminal in their lack of accepting China's good faith and blocking the ability of the world to examine secret American labs from which this bug probably came. Now, Winston's words were picked up by the Chinese state media and by Chinese diplomats, who now have a huge presence on Twitter, from which they growl and troll. and they spread the wise words of Winston to the world. And then a couple of weeks later, the Swiss embassy in Beijing, and the Swiss are quite sharp on this stuff, they know who's who in Switzerland, tweeted that they'd be rather keen to meet Winston because they had no record of him existing. And fairly soon after this, the Twitter and Facebook accounts went dead. And it turned out that they'd only been created a matter of days before the postings. The picture used on the Facebook account was of a library at Oxford. There were three supposed friends. It was a fake account. It had been set up in order to perpetuate disinformation. Disinformation, of course, which is now somewhat more sophisticated than the sort of thing that perhaps Graham Greene would have been doing during the war. But I wonder, you know, where Winston Edwards might have fitted in a Graham Greene narrative. Other characters who fascinated me for similar reasons. You'll all be familiar probably with David Petraeus. David Petraeus was the US commander in Iraq during the surge there, which turned around the fortunes of the US operation in Iraq. I met the guy when I was covering the war in Iraq. I spent some time with him doing a profile. And he's a very approachable individual. And he went on after the Iraq war to head the CIA. Then he was abruptly sacked after a scandal where it turned out he was having an extramarital affair with his biographer. Now, this was fascinating because you'll recall in a lot of Greene books that the rendezvous with illicit lovers, many of them married, the way they communicate with each other, of course, in The Comedians, when they meet under the statue of Columbus in Port-au-Prince, the way these rendezvous are worked out. And the way Petraeus did it was, because he was a spy chief after all, was a technique they used to describe as foldering. And what happened, he and the lady he was seeing created a fake email account and under someone else's name. And when they needed to communicate or set up meetings, they drafted an email and put that draft in the drafts folder. It was never sent, because if it was sent, it could have been accessed. It could have been intercepted in their view if people were looking for something. So what would happen is that the email would never leave the drafts folder. So one or other would log in, because they shared the credentials, and they would access the drafts folder and communicate with each other through the drafts folder. And that's in the espionage business, that's known as foldering. It's a bit old hat now, and it was even old hat really when Petraeus was, and I'm not quite sure how he was rumbled, but they did discover him, and that was the end of his CIA career. But he's now, you know, he's re-emerged really, doing a lot of punditry, pops up a lot on TV here and there. And again, that left me wondering, what would Graham Greene have made of that? Because it seemed almost tailor-made for a... And the other character who I think brings out so many of the ambiguities is, of course, Edward Snowden. Now, would Edward Snowden... I mean, is he a hero? Is he a traitor? Now, in my books, I imagine Graham Greene would initially certainly have described him as a hero. Graham Greene was close to Philby, but he was sympathetic to Philby. Snowden, after all, justified what he did by saying he was exposing mass surveillance, which was illegal in the US, and he was exposing this mass surveillance campaign, this mass surveillance operation that the National Security Agency was conducting. Now, at the same time, he also exposed US operations against China and Russia and others. Now, I covered the Edward Snowden story from Hong Kong because I happened to be there when he fled, when Snowden fled to Hong Kong, and then there was about a month when he was in hiding. We now know that he was under the wing of some local NGOs that dealt with refugee cases. There's still a lot of murkiness about what happened in terms of when he left Hong Kong, because he was able to leave the country, fly to Sheremetyevo in Moscow with a view to going on perhaps to Ecuador, but never got any further than Moscow. Now, after 3 or 4 weeks in Hong Kong, his face was perhaps one of the most famous that anybody could imagine in Hong Kong. Everybody knew what he looked like, but somehow he managed to get from where he was hiding to the airport and get out of the country and turn up in Russia. An ex-US intelligence officer who I spoke to when I was researching one of my books was sure that he'd visited the Russians in Hong Kong, although I'm not so sure about that. But what I am quite certain about, although this has never been published, even in the various books that have been written about Snowden, is that I'm pretty certain he was given safe passage out of Hong Kong by the Chinese authorities, who didn't want to be landed with him, because at the time this was seen as a potential embarrassment. The US were after him, and if he was seen to be given any sort of protection by China, they were very sensitive to that at the time, and I think he was told pretty bluntly to get out of Hong Kong. They would not harass him when he got out, but not to cause any issues, but just to leave. I'm not sure that he intended to stay in Russia, because he was stuck at Sheremetyevo for a while, looking to see whether he should go on anywhere else, but then ended up staying in Russia. And I think a postscript to this story, and why, you know, the moral ambiguity side of it comes to the fore quite considerably, is you might have seen last week Vladimir Putin gave him Russian citizenship, which arguably he would like to go back to the States and perhaps make his case, but the risks involved in that are very high, because he might never get out of jail again. But here he is under the wing of a man, and just in the years from 2013, when Snowden was in Hong Kong, yes, those who looked hard enough could see back then that Putin was a thug, but there were those who were still trying to give him the benefit of the doubt back then. And of course, now there is no benefit of the doubt. And we haven't heard very much at all from Snowden recently, and here he has been given citizenship by Putin. So you're left with a lot of kind of ambiguities about, how do you view Snowden? And just in the few years since he made his revelations in 2013, of course, it's the world has changed a lot, and the threat from China, in particular the threat from Russia, have come to the fore far more. That's intriguing, and it also opens a whole question about sort of loyalties. One of the themes that often runs through Green's books is the sense of loyalty not to a country or a flag, but loyalty to friends, loyalty to family. Where do loyalties lie? This is a theme that recurs. And in someone like Snowden, I'm sure Snowden would have made a fantastic character in a Graham Greene book. I'm convinced of it. But how would he have treated him? Would he see him as a tragic character, as somebody, someone like Pyle, innocence writ large? But was he innocent? I mean, was he naive? Did he think that what he was doing was good and right and important, but then get himself involved with a geopolitical situation which was far different and far more serious? And you can see how all these dilemmas could emerge in the examination of a character like Edward Snowden. It's it's intriguing. I mean, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange would be a similar similarly interesting character, somebody who claimed a higher purpose in what he was doing, but managed to alienate just about everybody he's come into contact with, even sympathetic journalists and friends who put money up for him, ended up regarding him as something of a narcissist. And of course, WikiLeaks itself has a higher purpose of enabling whistleblowers, but it also enabled Russian disinformation, which was highly damaging. So you come to look at these characters from a very sort of Greenesque point of view, and the sort of dilemmas and the sort of mixed loyalties and would are almost tailor-made for a Graham Greene novel. And I sometimes do sit there thinking, well, how would he have handled that? I'm conscious I'm probably running out of time here. I mean, I'd really love to sort of open it up and get your views. But let me finish with one little story, which again has a Greenesque element to it and cyber. It was during a time that I was working in China, and I was fascinated by a story I'd come across about a stand-up comedian. And this character, Chinese student as he was when he went to the States, had gone to New York, and he'd got heavily into the stand-up comedy scene in New York. And he'd been there several years. Then when he returned to China, he wanted to try and emulate that, try and develop a stand-up comedy scene in Beijing, and started to do these shows at a small venue, a small bar in Huhai, which is near the lake in Huhai, which is just to the north in Beijing, behind the Forbidden City. And I came across him because I'd read an interview he'd given to an English language paper in which he said he was disappointed because no one laughed. And I couldn't figure this out, and so I arranged to have a drink with him just to see how it would work, why it was. And I thought, we sat down, and I talked to him, and I suggested that maybe stand-up comedy didn't really travel, maybe because stand-up comedy tends to be quite political, that you had to be cautious in China. You couldn't ridicule Xi Jinping, because it would get you into kind of all sorts of different problems. And he looked at me and he said, no, he says, none of that. He said, it's just I think modern China is beyond parody. And I thought about that afterwards, and I think about it now, and a final thought is, I'm sure that Graham Greene would have found a way.
Thank you so much, Ian, for a very interesting, stimulating talk. A few things occurred to me. I mean, just generally confirmation that Greene is always relevant. Thought about William Golding's comment that Greene was the, a great chronicler of 20th century man's consciousness. Well, that goes on into the 21st century, can't just limit that to the 20th century. And the Roomba vacuum cleaner and Our Man in Havana, I just thought about the, Dr. Hasselbacher's reaction to Wormald's mention of the atomic pile. I didn't know science had got that far. a vacuum cleaner that can map every inch of our homes. Of course, we open up the floor to questions for Ian or stroke comments.
Thank you, Vishok. It's really interesting. I do agree that Julian Assange is a very Greenian hero, and I would also agree that Pyle and Snowden are quite similar. If you look at it from that lens, certainly the mainstream media didn't look at Snowden in that way for most of his sort of period of fame. But I think that has a lot of mileage, so we're looking forward to that next novel. I'm actually writing a story about disaster capitalism and sort of how technology can be used to create these shacks that billionaires can use to survive the apocalypse. And there was a Guardian article about how a sort of idealist has come along and said, well, you need a community in order to protect you, because a lot of billionaires were saying, well, we need to have sort of security measures so that the staff are forced to serve us in moments when, you know, they might revolt. So perhaps, you know, we should have dog collars. And, you know, this idealist has started to try to persuade them that actually if you have a doctor, if you have, you know, all the trades, all the professions, and you sort of give them a self-sustaining farm and whatever, and everyone's happy, then you're much more likely to survive the apocalypse. So it seems to me that there is a story there that Green might have managed to make work, but quite a depressing story.
Yeah,
and I'd be very interested in your feedback.
Yeah, but also there are the unintended consequences of technology. You know, you have people with lots of money that decide we want to immunize ourselves against threats and do it in a very high-tech way. But then there are all sorts of consequences that flow from that for other people. And it's not as simple as one very rich person making a decision about their own future. It resonates. It has an impact. It affects other people's livelihoods and lives as well, which I guess is a very sort of Green-esque theme. And it also perhaps plays to the bigger question of would Graham Greene have been a technophile or a technophobe? Would he have embraced all the new devices, or would he have been sort of fairly appalled about the potential consequences of a lot of all this for humankind?
Yes, perhaps he would have preferred to be part of the wandering hordes who sort of go on a King Lear-esque journey, you know, and may not survive the apocalypse, because what's the point at that point?
Yeah, perhaps, but I think we're finding now that some of the sort of more obscure and offbeat and authoritarian little places have embraced surveillance technology and other intrusive technologies with an enthusiasm and without any sort of constraints that you might have in more democratic societies. So a lot of these techniques and technologies are being used to underpin the rule of some pretty thuggish types who don't have to depend upon any oversight or regulation. It's a fascinating.
Hard to make it work, I think. I think yes. you need the Greenian touch to sort of find the comedy and the human heart of that story.
Exactly, and the comedy, I think, is a great, you know, I mean, the comedians, I think, is one of my favourite. I mean, I know at one point Graham Greene tried to divide his novels, I think he stopped doing it after a while, into the serious ones and the entertainments. And I probably, especially in my early days, had a sort of preference. I veered towards the entertainments, the thrillers, and I just love the way that he created comedy out of serious people and serious situations, and that device remains extremely strong, and arguably is as important as ever in the sort of cyber technology computer era.
Just following on from that, I'd be really interested in your thoughts of what he would have made of a Bezos or a Zuckerberg and the kind of geopolitical power of, you know, a Meta or a Facebook almost, and whether you would have seen that same sort of criticism of the sort of naivety of American power in the early Cold War applied now to the big tech firms as they contemplate the metaverse or whatever else.
I think that's a very good question, and I've often wondered about that as well, because you have private companies which are incredibly powerful, particularly in the tech sphere, arguably wield more power and have control over more sensitive data than governments. and the capacity to misuse that power and misuse that data. And there's an anecdote which I used in one of my books when I wrote Beijing Smog about this internet meme that goes viral and creates all sorts of problems for people. And of course, the Chinese blogger that first posted has no idea what he's creating because it's done as a joke. But he also, in my book, creates this game, a video game or an app, whereby all these little stick aliens come out from underneath the portrait of Mao in Tiananmen Square. And the idea of the game is you have these big fly swats and you squash these little aliens as they come out, and a lot of them are carrying money. And I thought in promoting the book, I'd get the game made because this would be quite a good way of promoting the book. So I got a friend of mine to actually make exactly the same game and then sent the app off to the Apple store, which is normally a fairly quick technical process to get it approved. And a month later, I'd heard nothing. So I resubmitted it. Then I ended up getting an email from Cupertino asking me to phone a number, which I phoned. And I found myself talking to the Apple compliance department, who told me that my app, while was technically sound, the content was inappropriate, and that it broke certain laws and would therefore not be submitted to the Chinese app store. So I asked them, well, what aspect of this is inappropriate? Which laws? And they fumbled around. She couldn't, well, I do not have that information. It was like talking to a Chinese Communist Party apparatchik, and this is Apple in Cupertino. And I followed this up with several letters and emails, none of which were answered, all ignored. And Apple has often presents itself as a big defender of privacy. Privacy is a human right. But of course, a lot of these values stop at the China border, which is too important to them as a market and as a place where their goods are assembled. And for a lot of we'd assumed until then that companies, big corporates, technology companies who are trying to get a slice of the Chinese market, censor. They've always said, we only censor when countries ask us to take something down and with good justification if it breaks a law. And this to me was evidence that Apple was preemptively censoring on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party. And that made for, but this is a long way of coming back around to say that you're absolutely right, that the corporate, particularly technology companies, the power is quite frightening, and the capacity to misuse it.
Thank you very much.
I was just wondering if I could draw you to extend your comments in relation to two situations, or if you don't feel like commenting, don't. One is Bukele's El Salvador, and the commitment to crypto. And the reason I ask that is because it was a place where Graham Greene was so active at the end of his life. And the other, where he wasn't active, would be Tigray, where with the loss of the internet, the medical infrastructure is pretty much wrecked. There's an article about it in the London Review of Books the other day. I have no special knowledge of it. It just sort of pops into my mind as two world situations where the internet seems hugely important to people's lives.
It is. The internet infrastructure arguably has become a great enabler of all sorts of infrastructure and services. And the loss of that infrastructure can be enormously damaging in ways which affect ordinary people, whether it's through health, education. The crypto example in El Salvador, I mean, crypto it's fascinating in a sense. And if you again come at it from a slightly sort of Greenesque lens, it's crypto, when it was first introduced, was seen as a great liberating technology. It was very much seen as a way of decentralizing, a way of breaking the traditional old banking system. It was a big libertarian tool. But of course, the way it's actually developed and the way that crypto and other electronic currencies are developing is it's in fact empowering governments rather than empowering people who would wish to be separate from governments. So it's intriguing, and a lot of it depends sometimes on the government you're dealing with. I mean, El Salvador, I mean, China is a long way ahead on e-currencies, and e-currencies are in many ways the ultimate means of surveillance, because you know everything about those who would like to know can find everything out about what you're spending, where you're going, how you're traveling. I mean, the amount of data that becomes available if it's not properly protected about every aspect of your life, because your payment, because it's a centralized payment system, which probably isn't directly answering your question, but...
Thank you very much for that very interesting talk. I just have an observation, really. You may have some comments on that. When we talk about the social media, I feel that Graham Greene enjoyed going to dangerous places in the world, which he obviously wrote some of his books from. And I think with the social media and the use of the internet, maybe that would have put the brakes on Graham Greene of being able to do what he did when he was writing his books and traveling. And I think he would be disappointed with that he may have to do a lot of the discoveries sitting in at his desk rather than actually going to the places. And probably those places today, through various changes in the geopolitical system, he wouldn't have any access to it now. For example, if I may use what is been reported in the Ukrainian war, he may not have been able to get to the front to observe what was going on, because much of the feedback to the journalists are being given to the journalists who are staying in hotels in Kiev. So maybe he would have been disappointed with the development of the social media side of today.
I think that's a fair observation, because in his day, and this lasted, I mean, I some of the early conflicts that I covered in It was still possible to roam around. You could still get up to front lines. You could still get access to people and bases. But it has become far more difficult to get the sort of frontline access that he was able to enjoy through his own tenacity, through his own reputation, through the commissions that he was given from different newspapers. And I think the reality now of reporting in conflict zones is it is a lot more difficult, as you point out, to get the frontline access. And a lot of what you're getting is through social media postings. And in fact, one interesting element to this is the whole growth of open source intelligence. Bellingcat being an example of that, they dubbed themselves an intelligence agency for the people. And the sheer amount of information which is out there, if you look and search hard enough on open source platforms, whether it's through satellites, Google Earth, or from stuff that's just posted and forgotten about. People forget that when the Uyghur detention camps in Xinjiang, when information about that first came out, this wasn't necessarily the governments and the UN were running behind the curve. They mostly came out through open source intelligence, because researchers looked at imagery from satellites and Google Earth and looked at, and you can do time lapses. You can go back in time and look at how it looked a few years ago and how it looked now. And they saw the growth of these huge prison complexes across Xinjiang. They also looked closely at procurement notices from local governments and the explosion in demand for security workers and police and other stuff that had been posted and left on the internet. And the picture that emerged from this investigation was assembled by open source researchers sitting at computers. And that was complemented, obviously, by eyewitness reports, people that were being had managed to escape from some of these prisons or simply got over the border into Kazakhstan, but with stories about what was happening. But yeah, I guess that's a long way of saying that it is generally more difficult now to do the sort of reporting that Graham Greene did, to get that access, to get to the front line, to do the sort of, I mean, I think there's no substitution in sitting down with someone face to face and having that interaction and witnessing things firsthand. But you need to be arguably more tenacious and more determined to get at that. And he was tenacious and he was determined, so arguably he would have found a way. But yes, there are all these other multiple sources of information at the moment, much of it instant, but much of it as well fallible, much of it wrong, much of it malicious, much of it made up. You know, you have to be, in the old days when you were a journalist on the ground there, you knew how to judge a source, because he or she was sitting down in front of you, and it was a professional skill to be able to decide what was rubbish and what was plausible. Whereas it's become much more challenging to do that, especially with tighter deadlines, and with, I think, as I mentioned during the talk, with the internet being such an enabler of false narratives and alternative reality.
And just we'd like to react from your last statement. My grandfather used to mention how he looked on quite poorly on the journalist at the Nairobi hotel where he was during the Mau Mau, and he actually managed to get into a British army patrol and go out on the field during the insurrection. But most of the journalists were just in the hotel and taking on the different information that the British government was willing to disseminate. So I think it's something that's not really changed much since, and it still needs a lot of courage to get the information.
Yep.
I would like also to mention that in 88 I bought my first computer, and quite chuffed. I talked to my grandfather about it, and he was appalled, and he said it was just a fad and it would just all go away.
It's interesting, actually. I add an anecdote to the hotel theme, because I was in Vilnius in 1990, I think it was, when President Landsbergis had declared independence, and there was a lot of speculation about whether Gorbachev at the time would send the troops in to crush this independence. And we were all staying in the same hotel, all the press, and we were scrambling to try and get information about what was going on. And there was a very prominent tabloid journalist who I should not name, but who was also at the hotel and frequently there, usually propping up the bar. He serviced a number of the UK tabloids. And one morning, we all began to get calls because we'd learned from the early editions that, I think it was the Mail on Sunday, had a front page which read, Vitalis Landsbergis knelt by his bed last night and prayed. And that was the opening line. And of course, editors across Fleet Street are saying, why did you not have this story? So Harry, shall we call him, was in the bar, as was his usual habitat, confronted by a number of journalists, and said, Harry, how did you know that Landsbergis was knelt by his bed and prayed? To which Harry replies, well, he said, if he didn't, he should have bloody done.
Thank you, Ian. That was really thought-provoking. And even before Andrew shared with us his grandfather's suspicion of computers, I was going to say, I think Graham Greene would have had a mobile phone, but made sure he left it at home. He would have really resented the way it's a tracking device that many of us don't seem to fully take on board. You know, just how. Just to throw out another character that I think Greene would have been interested in, and that's and the phenomenon, picking up on your point about how much false information has been, we were aware, is disseminated now. Alex Jones and InfoWars, you know, a man who can take the killing of small children and make money out of saying it was actors. It wasn't parents crying. It was actors. It was all false. And I think that sort of situation would have appalled and intrigued Green.
I think so. I think appalled. I mean, thankfully, the truth is catching up with him. But I think you're right. It would have appalled and intrigued him probably in equal measures. And you could see an Alex Jones figure making his way into a Graham Greene novel, where he would have been able to explore the malice, but also the absurdity of the man. One would hope so.
Do you think Greene would have tried to be among those reporters in Iraq and Afghanistan that were embedded with the troops to try to get the real story? Do you think Greene would have gone for that? Would have tried to do that?
Ooh, it's a tough question. I mean, there's I suppose in Fowler in The Quiet American, he was the equivalent of being embedded with the French on a couple of occasions. I think there's a scene there with the dive bomber and other. But clearly the idea then of going out with the troops was very different from the embedded correspondence today, where the aim is equally to control what you can see and where you go. I mean, it's always presented as being for your own well-being and safety, but gone are the days when you can just wander around the front line. You are quite tightly controlled. I think he probably would have done, but I think he would have done it with a very skeptical eye and with a good deal of innovation, shall we say, and a good deal of... when you go on these things, I mean, I've been doing the Iraq War. I was embedded with the Black Watch for 3 or 4 weeks when they came up from Basra too. And they're kind of trying to lead you by the nose in terms of what they want to tell you and what you want to see. But it's never that efficient. And I think the sloppier journalists will just accept what they're fed. But there are always journalists who are more tenacious, who are more questioning, who are more skeptical. And I think that is the category in which Graham Greene would have come into. And you'd like to think that you would find the, if there was no alternative, you would be embedded, but you'd find ways of trying to get between the cracks.
Thank you.
Ian, we do need to finish there. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.